Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. Honorable Supervisor, I am now in open session, pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning, be seated, please. Justice Stratton is not able to be with us for oral arguments, but she's read the briefs, and we taped the arguments, so she will be participating in the decisions in the cases we hear today. The first case is 00610, Annie M. Thomas versus the City of Cleveland. Mr. Iskin.
Good morning. Peter Iskin, attorney for appellant. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The issue of this appeal is whether athletes failed to provide Ms. Thomas and Ms. Taylor with an opportunity for a due process hearing at a meaningful time after the city seized and detained their cars pursuant to the forfeiture procedure in Ohio Revised Code Section 2933.43, which I will refer to as the forfeiture statute. The relevant facts in this case are undisputed. The parties stipulated to the entire factual record. Appellants are potential innocent owners under the forfeiture statute. This means that when the city seized their car pursuant to the forfeiture statute, the third party was driving the car and arrested in the underlying criminal case.
Are you looking for damages from the City of Cleveland for the detention of the property?
That is correct, Your Honor.
How would they be quantified?
The damages would be in connection with the loss of the use of the car for the period of time in which the car was held and should not have been held. Also, there was damage to the cars during the extended period of time that they were held in the city impound lot, 13 months for Ms. Taylor, 7 months for Ms. Taylor.
I recognize this isn't part of your argument. You wonder whether or not, I understand the basic issue, and I do, whether or not the statute was complied with and whether or not they had the right to retain it. My concern is I want to go to the issue, is their defense going to be sovereign immunity?
No, Your Honor. This is a due process claim brought pursuant to Section 1983, so there's no immunity for the city with respect to the monetary claims under the state statute. And they have no immunity. There's no qualified immunity for the city as well. Qualified immunity in 1983 claims only exist if you're suing an individual, not a municipality.
Okay, thank you.
A potential innocent owner is an innocent owner under the forfeiture statute if she neither knew nor should have known after a reasonable inquiry that the third party would use was likely to use the car in the alleged crime. The forfeiture statute provides an innocent owner with the substantive right to recover her car.
That's what I was going to ask you about. What steps did she take to recover her car?
Well, immediately after the seizure of the car, both Ms. Thomas and Ms. Taylor contacted the city requesting to get their cars back, and they were told that their cars were being held subject to forfeiture and the forfeiture hearing. And subsequently, they repeated their request, and they were told the same thing. So they were unable to get their car back until the city would permit them to do so.
If the statutory scheme ought to have permitted the police ought to have released the car within 72 hours if the prosecutor wasn't filing a forfeiture. In that event, though, your client was obviously harmed here by an error or mistake, we would not need to declare the statute unconstitutional.
That's correct. The Attorney General has presented an interpretation of the statute which would have required the city and the prosecutor to release the cars within 3 days after the seizure of the cars. Notwithstanding our analysis in our reply brief of pages 3 through 4, appellants do not object to the court adopting the Attorney General's interpretation of the statute. And in that event, the statute would not be unconstitutional on its face. However, appellees still will have violated appellants' due process rights to a due process hearing at a meaningful time.
It wouldn't be a unconstitutionality of the statute itself. There would have been some sort of breach by the city and negligence. I mean, wouldn't be an unconstitutional. It would just be a mistake by the city, or they didn't follow the law.
It would be, the statute would be constitutional on its face, but as applied, there would have been a constitutional violation. The statute creates the due process property interest here, namely the innocent owner's right to recover her car. Once that due process property interest is established, the federal due process law, not state law, determines the due process property rights. And because appellees did not return appellant's car within 3 days after the seizure of the car,
you say that would still be...
appellees will have failed to provide appellant with a due process right to a hearing at a meaningful time.
Mm-hmm.
So if the city violated the statute in this case, then it simply means that they violated both state law and due process.
I thought the Attorney General's brief was well done, and their proposition made sense to me, that you should construe the statute that way. They wouldn't have put that 72 hours in there if there wasn't some reason for it. What objection do you have to that offense? Why wouldn't you construe it the same way? Because you win either way.
Well, I
understand you.
The problem...
Are they wrong?
I hate to say they're wrong because I like the result.
Yeah.
The problem is Revised Code Section 2933.43B2, the second paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mouthful, but if you can find it in there, it's not an easy statute to read. I think everyone would concede. That section applies to contraband of the type described in 2901.01A13C, I believe. And that's contraband, that is contraband by virtue of the fact that a revised code section calls it contraband. And in this case, we have a car that becomes contraband because of 2933.42B. This is tape, so you can...
Well, 13G under 0113G refers to vehicle as a contraband. That's your argument, isn't it? That a vehicle is contraband, and the other argument is whether the vehicle is carrying the contraband. But your argument is that under G, I would guess it is, that the vehicle is listed, designated by the General Assembly as contraband.
Well, if it were contraband under G, then the bar under B2, the second paragraph, would not apply. The question is, key question is it contraband under 13A13C? And if it is, then the bar for release of the property applies. If it's contraband that's not A or C, but rather B, D, through H or I, then there would not be a bar on the release of the car. There would not be a bar on the rebuttal. Those types of contraband are covered by 2933.43B2, the first paragraph. And that first paragraph says, you shall not release the car subject to the B1. And B1 is the release provision, 43B1. The second paragraph says, notwithstanding B1, you shall not release the car. And so I think notwithstanding clearly means B1 release does not apply. So that's the key question here.
It says, it actually says pending a hearing pursuant to Division C of this section.
Correct.
And C is only triggered if the prosecutor files for a forfeiture. In other words, there is no hearing. There would be pending a hearing suggests to me that is only triggered in the event that the prosecutor has filed for a forfeiture.
I think the answer is that pending a hearing needs to be considered as pending a hearing or pending the need for a hearing. And I think there are other portions of C that support that.
To say that your point is it wouldn't, that hearing that it refers to, pending a hearing pursuant to Division C, is something other than the hearing triggered where the prosecutor files for forfeiture?
I think that is what pending a hearing is referring to.
Yeah.
In 43C, there are other provisions for release of the car. If the charges are not brought within 30 days, if charges are brought, then they're dismissed, which could happen 2-3 months down the road, and no forfeiture petition need be filed. The forfeiture petition, as has been shown in the brief, could be filed at the end of the criminal case. It could happen 3 months down the road, and so...
But if none is filed within 72 hours, then your client... The city had a mandatory duty to return the car. Your client would have been in a position to file a replevin action at that point.
I don't believe that's true. I think that the statute is saying that when the car is seized and detained pursuant to the forfeiture statutes, you hold the car until the hearing occurs, pending the
But
hearing.
There wouldn't be a hearing if they didn't file for forfeiture.
But they have a right to file a forfeiture petition up to the conclusion of the underlying criminal case. So you do not know within 72 hours if you'll be filing a forfeiture petition.
I would like to get to the facts of this particular case. The prosecutor did not file a forfeiture proceeding. Does that weaken your case? How do you respond to the fact that the prosecutor did not file a forfeiture?
I don't think it weakens our case at all. The seizure of property to which the requirements of procedural due process attach in this case is the seizure and detention of the car pursuant to the forfeiture statute, not to the filing of a forfeiture petition. And the failure to file a forfeiture petition may mean that there was no right to a hearing under the statute, but it does not mean that there was no right to a hearing at a meaningful time under due process.
What would that meaningful time be?
Our position is that it's within approximately 3 days after the seizure of the car, exactly as this court held in the innocent owner impoundment case in Hackhauser.
But they just kept telling you that they had a right to hold the car. They would not provide you with a hearing, did they?
That's correct. Their procedure was to hold the forfeiture hearing, which is totally different than the matter of an innocent owner getting the car back, after the conclusion of the underlying criminal case, and the innocent owner hearing is at the forfeiture hearing. So they were waiting until the criminal case was over.
The criminal cases were over in both instances, and they they retained the car of one, I think, 3 months, and the other 4 months. What was their excuse there?
I don't think they had any excuse. We were in litigation, they didn't get around to offering it back to us. But they had no good reason.
Did you attempt to secure the automobiles after the guilty or after the cases were the criminal cases were terminated?
Yeah, we consistently wanted to get the car back as soon as we could, and the offer was made at the time noted in the brief.
You're not, I thought something you said makes me think that you're suggesting that there needs to be a hearing for the 72-hour requirement. That's not, I misheard you, I think, did I not? The statute says the person gets the car back in 72 hours. There's no hearing required, is there?
That's right.
If
you construe the statute as the Attorney General has, then there is no requirement for a hearing. There would simply be an automatic release of the car within 72 hours if the government did not need to retain the car for investigatory or evidentiary purposes, which they always have the right to do. And the innocent owner's right to recover a car is subject to the government's right to keep the car for investigatory or evidentiary purposes. What I was referring to is if the statute does not require that automatic release, and we're then looking at what due process requires, then there would be a matter of a hearing for the innocent owner to prove he isn't an innocent owner and thus trying to get the car.
What would you like us to eventually find? I've read your, and you lay all this out in your reply brief with regard to the AG, and I understand that. But I just wonder, again, you don't even have, in effect, a prayer in your conclusion in your reply brief. What would you like us to do?
Well, my conclusion is in my brief on the merits, and I would like the court either to accept the interpretation of the statute that the Attorney General presented, but also find that, as applied in this case, that the appellants were denied due process rights to a hearing opportunity in meaningful time, or to reject the Attorney General's interpretation, to find that the statute on its face, as well as applied, deny the felons their right to a innocent owner hearing at a meaningful time, and to find that the meaningful time of that hearing is within approximately 3 days after the seizure of the car.
And your preference is the latter?
Actually, I don't have a preference.
Well, if that's your conclusion on page 12.
But I think there are some problems with the analysis of the statute for the Attorney General. And we're, of course, then seeking monetary damages just against the city, not against the prosecutor. I saw in the summary here it indicated damages against the prosecutor. That's not what we're seeking. And we are seeking declaratory relief against the city and the prosecutor. Of course, our claims for injunctive relief are moot at this stage. And I would respect the mootness, with respect to the claim against the city, the monetary claim is not moot, and in connection with the monetary claim, the court may also grant declaratory relief. And with respect to the declaratory claim against the prosecutor, I think this case falls directly within the mootness exception for constitutional.
It has run out. Thank you, Mr. Iskin. Mr. Brady.
Hey, please report. My name is Matthew Brady, and I represent the city of Cleveland. As Justice Cook pointed out, in this case, the statute does not prohibit a clubbing or a lease of property. 2933.43 days. Therefore, due process is not violated in this statute.
Well, but a person shouldn't have to file a replevin action to get their car back under these circumstances, should they? There clearly was an error here by the city, was there not?
Yes, Your Honor, there's no question.
The city had followed the statute, I guess, unless they needed the car for investigative purposes, but the city had followed the statute, Mr. Iskin's client would have had the car back in 72 hours.
And whatever I stand here and pretend that the city followed the letter of the statute, in fact, I would argue that this statute, the constitutionality of the statute, is not questioned in this case because the city never followed the statute.
What about Mr. Iskin's suggestion that, as applied, the statute was applied unconstitutionally to his client? It's not on its face, it's not unconstitutional, but as applied,
Well, again, Your Honor, we follow the statute. Actually, the county has a responsibility in our jurisdiction to file a forfeiture petition. We never did that. The city, on the other hand, does have a responsibility to follow up with the prosecutor and find out whether, in fact, they did file a forfeiture petition, which they did not. Perhaps had there been better record keeping or verification, this would not happen. And the trial court found that the city did the wrong thing, and the trial court awarded damages to the Legal Aid Society's clients. I think that these perhaps is the type of case that Legal Aid should pursue as the constitutionality of the statute. However, I think under these facts, the constitutionality of the statute can't be questioned since we didn't follow the statute. Nevertheless, as Justice Cook pointed out, the Attorney General also wrote a very concise and well-written opinion regarding the 72-hour provisions. And if you look at that provision, and I'm not going to try to cite the ABCs or Section 2 or whatever, Mr. Russell addressed the heavy lifting on this case, I hope. But it does carve out an exception for vehicles that are not in custody and control of the owners when they are seized. And in other words, the legislature carefully crafted this statute in order to provide safeguards for so-called innocent owners. In this case, although I don't agree with Justice Cook that there's a mandatory return of car report after 72 hours if you don't request an extension, and the reason I say that is because the word shall is in the statute. In all cases, not in every case, does that impose a mandatory duty, particularly where, as here, the court should try to uphold the constitutionality of the statute. Again, that's a good summary of facts with the constitutionality of the statute.
Counselor, help me with the help me with the procedure in this case, just quickly, if you will. Didn't the trial court hold for the plaintiffs in this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
And didn't the Court of Appeals affirm that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Then why are they appealing? What else do they want us to do?
That's a good question.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. And especially where a service city case, like some of the damages, or damages were levied against us for this. So that's an open question.
I think they want us to declare the statute unconstitutional, don't they?
I believe so.
Yeah, I think that goes beyond the facts in this case. That's the way I read it.
Yes, Your Honor, and again, if you read the statute carefully, and it is somewhat confusing, and I think Mr. Russ may be able to clarify this a little bit, but it's true that there's a bar to levy or release of property once you file a forfeiture petition, but simply seizing the car does not allow you to hold it with no due process rights for whoever the unfortunate person who's having to lend their car to the defendant in the case. It does provide safeguards, and it's right here in the 72-hour provision. What should happen in these cases is that if the law enforcement wants to hold the car for a longer period, they should request an extension. If they don't do that, then they're not, the car isn't continuing to be lawfully seized, and therefore they don't have the protection of the bar against replevant or release of property. At any time, the owner can come in and file a replevant, and they're entitled to a hearing. And once there's a hearing, there's due process. If at that point the prosecutor wants to file their petition for forfeiture, they can do so, and again, we'll have a hearing.
And damages. I mean, in the replevant action, there could be damages if there were undue delays. So it would suffice to stop the city from making such errors. Ultimately, you know, some people have to file. I wonder if you could. Is the Attorney General going to argue?
I don't
no.
think so.
The position argued in that brief, I take it that you've studied it, says that B2 does not apply to vehicles. And I'm wondering, that since B2 states it applies to any property that is contraband, can we really say that B2 does not apply to vehicles?
There are B2, 2833, 2832, 2128.
It says...
No, I believe it applies. But again, vehicles are not per se contraband. And it's important to make that distinction as well, as I'm sure the court has. The vehicle can only be contraband. If there's a presumption of contraband, if it's seized in connection with a felony criminal offense, however, you can't make a final determination as to whether that was contraband until the underlying criminal felony is determined. Once the felony is convicted, then you can determine whether or not that car should be seized pursuant to the court for statute. However, that never happened because no petition was filed. And we are practicing. But that is the way that it should work. Somewhere between the 72-hour expiration of the investigatory stop and in Casalicio, you know, they held that the forfeiture petition should be filed within around 5.5 months. At some point in time, the city should have done something to find out that the person is held here in the car. They should be called to the prosecutor or the prosecutor did do that. The trial court noted that the court of appeals affirmed the decision against the city, and the city paid damages for that suit. And therefore, Your Honor, I would submit, unless there are further questions, or let Mr. Russ address the court, that the decision of the trial court and the court of appeals should be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Brady. Mr. Russ.
Please report. Good morning. I'm Christopher Russ, Assistant Prosecuting Attorney, Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office. And my recommendation that you're going to go basically to the due process concerns that were raised. I would also agree with Mr. Brady that this case on its facts does not present a constitutional question, and that the analysis of the statute leads to one inescapable conclusion that it is replete with due process protections. When I refer to the statute, I refer to paragraph 33 and 43, unless otherwise noted. Under A2 of the statute, it provides that the law enforcement agency must give notice for a vehicle or for any property that's titled or registered under law. In this case, we're talking about motor vehicles. That occurs either orally, by telephone included, or by certified mail return receipt request. Under B1 of the statute, then, this is that motor vehicle exception that the General Assembly carved out. And I think an analysis of that section leads to the following conclusion. Within 72 hours, the law enforcement agency has to do one of two things. It either has to release the vehicle upon request of the owner, or it has to file an extension with the common police court. If it files an extension within the common police court, the statute provides that within 24 hours of the request for extension, that common police court must hold the hearing. So there's your first protection. This gives the, and also the statute provides that the owner is provided notice of the hearing that has been scheduled by the common police court. So the owner does have an opportunity at that point in time to come in and be heard.
Well, were all these things done in this case?
That was not done in this case, Your Honor. I don't think there's any question that in this case, though the specific steps of the statute were not followed. First of all, there was never any forfeiture petition filed. And secondly, apparently, I think the notice was given in both cases, in the Thomas case and the Taylor case. And one of the matters, the party was notified on the day of the arrest of the suspect driving the vehicle that the vehicle would be subject to forfeiture. And then in the other case, I think within 72 hours, the party was in fact orally notified, but then nothing else was done. The car was released upon request. So then
is that necessary? Doesn't the, in this instance, the city have the right to hold that car? They must give the notice, but they have the right to hold the car since it was used and suspected.
I think the state should probably have a right, if they petition the court, if they have to do by the end of the 72-hour period, if they have to petition the court in order to hold on to the car, and the court has a hearing on it and can issue an order, and I think the reading of the statute indicates that the discretion of the common police court as to how long they will allow the city to hold the car for investigation, inspection,
They still have the right to hold it until the criminal case is resolved.
I think it is.
You have that length of time to file the forfeiture proceeding.
Yes. The statute further provides that if the request is, if no request is filed, but it's not, or if it's filed but not granted, or at the extent of this extension period that the county police court may grant, the vehicle was not in custody control at the time of the seizure. And the owner of the vehicle was not charged with any offense involving the actual, in which the actual commission of offense the vehicle was used, then the vehicle must be released. It also provides the forfeiture required that the proof of ownership, an affidavit of the owner that they neither knew nor were in any express or implied consent for the use of the vehicle in the violation that the vehicle shall be released. The court can also report a bond.
Let me ask you. How does 2901.13G affect this? How do you interpret it? As you know, that's the section that says contraband. It identifies all types of property that are contraband, and vehicle, G, includes vehicle.
I read that to the alcohol and tobacco language, and that's the way I've interpreted that. I think the question or the issue that the appellants were trying to propose in this case is that C applied, and that therefore, because of the language in paragraph 2 of B2 that says, pending the forfeiture hearing and notwithstanding any provision in B1 for the contrary. But I think the flaw with that is if you look at, and C under 2901.13 says any property that's defined by statute to be contraband. And then the appellants would argue that 2933.42 says if you're using a vehicle to transport contraband, the vehicle itself is contraband. But that statute also has four categories: motor vehicles, aircraft, watercraft, and other personal property not specifically defined. So if you take those four categories, the General Assembly then carved out an exception for a motor vehicle. And I think in doing so, they've recognized some of the case law, particularly the security cases that talks about the automobile and its essential component of everyday life, and how people rely on automobiles for jobs and basic daily living. So they've carved out this 72-hour procedure to take it out of that definition of 2901.01.13C. And I think that makes sense in this case because it recognizes in an innocent owner situation that person is dependent upon a vehicle. It doesn't do that for watercraft, aircraft, and other personal property. So I think the analysis of the Attorney General on that point, I think sort of touches upon that and recognizes that. But why would the General Assembly go through this elaborate 72-hour procedure that provides for notice and hearing, et cetera, and then take it away in the very three or four paragraphs later in the statute. That doesn't make sense. I think the reasonable interpretation of the statute and harmonizing all the various sections of the statute leads to that conclusion.
Do you subscribe to the Attorney General's interpretation or to the Court of Appeals? Or do you have a fourth one?
Although I may not agree with the whole analysis, I think that aspect of the Attorney General's interpretation of the statute, I would agree. I think that's the reasonable interpretation of the statute. I think it harmonizes any current conflicts that may occur with the second paragraph of B2 and that notwithstanding language. I think the recognizing that the General Assembly carved out that exception under B1 for motor vehicles and didn't do that for the other three categories of contraband, for transporting contraband, locked up here, et cetera.
So is it fair to say that you want us to affirm the Court of Appeals, but for different reasons?
I think the that would move.
Or would not the Court of Appeals' opinion also be plausible?
I think the Court of Appeals' opinion, obviously the result is something I'm going to do. Some of the analysis, I'm not sure that I necessarily agree with all of it. And at this point in time, I can't point to specific provisions of it, but I think that analysis upholds the Constitution and outlines the statute in the abstract. In this case, again, I don't think that there's any question. The facts of this case do not present a constitutional question. Also, under C, the actual filing of the forfeiture petition, there are notice provisions and the opportunity to be heard. That portion of the statute provides for personal service notice or certified mail service to either the owner and or any person with security interest in the property. It also provides for notice to be published in a paper with general circulation one time each for 2 consecutive weeks. It provides that the hearing must be held within 45 days after conviction in a criminal case. And it goes on to provide the text for getting the opportunity to be heard to the innocent owner. If there's no property can be forfeited under the statute, if the owner establishes by preponderance of the evidence that they either knew or should have known after reasonable inquiry that the property was used and likely to use in the crime or administrative violation. So all those protections are present.
Thank you, Mr. Russ. Mr. Iskin, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Yes, please. I'd just like to clarify with respect to what the trial court did in this case. The trial court said that the violation that they found was very limited. They said that there was a violation only to the extent that the city retained the cars after the time period for the forfeiture hearing under the statute, which was, in this case, after the cars were already held for 10 months in one case and 5 months in the other case. And so the due process, the trial court did not find that there was a requirement to release the car within 3 days under the statute or have the hearing within 3 days under due process. And so and the damages that were stipulated to were only with respect to if that trial court decision was upheld. And so that's why we're here today.
No, so you want that vacated in its entirety remanded for trial and a new hearing on damages?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Skin. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.